The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Tonight, we're going to time travel from 1618 to 1960 with two very witty novelists who tackle big ideas with an acuity of craft, uniqueness of voice, and fully fleshed characters who reel you in from the first page to the last. Our first presenter, Joshua Cohen's acclaimed novels include Wits, Moving Kings, and Book of Numbers, one of the best novels ever written about the internet, according to Rolling Stone. He was one of Granta's best of young American novelists in 2017, and is the author of the short story collection, Four New Messages, and the book of essays, Attention, Dispatches from a Land of Distraction. Blurring the line between the real and the imagined, The Netanyahus follows a Jewish historian who unexpectedly must play host to Ben Zion Netanyahu, an exiled Israeli historian, and his family on a wintry upstate New York college campus. Josh will be joined tonight by Rivka Galchin, the author of Atmospheric Disturbances, a comical mystery that follows a doctor who believes his wife has been replaced with a duplicate. Her other works include the compendium Little Labors and a story collection, American Innovations. She was the recipient of a William Saroyan International Prize for Fiction Writing and a Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award. Her new novel, Everyone Knows Your Mother is a Witch, tells the tale of Katharina Kepler, a 17th century widow accused of witchcraft, who seeks help from her son, the renowned mathematician and astronomer, Johannes Kepler. Rivka, Josh, it's great to have both of you here. Josh, I believe you're starting us off, so the screen is yours.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Rivka. And Rivka is the only person I see on the screen, so I'm just gonna talk to her. And maybe I should also say hello to Philadelphia, if that means anything when you're doing it on Zoom. This book is sort of a Philadelphia book, maybe. It's certainly about a family who spent a lot of time, at least in Philadelphia and Cheltenham, the Netanyahus. And it's a book really about how the Netanyahus came to be in the United States, sort of backstory behind that. But it's really framed as a job interview that Benzion Netanyahu had, where he went up to a state school in upstate New York to interview for a position in medieval history. And he's hosted by a man named Reuben Blum, who is a professor of taxation studies. And he doesn't really, he's an Americanist. He's in sort of the American history department. He doesn't really know why he's being asked to bring around this man named Benzion Netanyahu. And his department chair says, well, because, you know, he's one of yours, he's a Jew. And so kind of saddled with this, Reuben Blum hosts Benzion Netanyahu, who shows up with his wife, Tzila, and his three children, Yoni Netanyahu, the middle child, Bibi Netanyahu, the future prime minister of Israel, and Ido Netanyahu, the youngest, who proceed to sort of take over his house and wreck the place. In between, there's probably too many lectures about medieval Jewry and the Inquisition, which was Benzion Netanyahu's specialty. This is subject of research interest. But I'm just going to read a small passage here from when the Netanyahus show up. Again, Reuben Blum, the narrator, is this sort of liberal American professor of taxation studies who is not expecting more than one person to show up. It's during winter as well, kind of right after Christmas. So I thought that it would be good to think of some snow on a day this hot. A car came chunking down Evergreen Street, chunking slow and near the curb. the better to look out for street numbers. We had a bronze 18 on the lintel out front, and our name, the Blums, on our mailbox, and the mailbox's post wasn't gussied up North Pole style, and our door was visibly unwreathed. Those are the directions that should have been given to Netanyahu. Keep a lookout for the one house here that isn't Santa's workshop. The car was a desert-colored, rusted-out Ford of the 1940s, Ponton and streamlined, and it must be said, slick for its day, which by the time it skidded down our street had already long been over. It was one of the first model cars they started making after the wartime hiatus, and one of the last model cars with a face, by which I mean the front of the thing, which it, with its widespread, high-socketed headlight eyes and grill-blit nose, was almost like a person. It came at you with this sweet, stupid, human look, this pitiable, dependent look that almost made you forget that its maker was a Nazi. This specimen was especially poignant because the face it presented was smashed. Its grill was missing and its dented chrome fender was half hanging off and kind of flicking the snow ahead of it like an impotent plow. But maybe this wasn't Netanyahu. For one, there were too many people inside the car. More than one person inside was too many, I thought. In Netanyahu's postcard he'd sent, he hadn't mentioned coming up accompanied, and yet this clown car heading toward me appeared to be so crammed that through my window in the car's windscreen, it wasn't clear to me how many passengers there were or what they were doing, fighting or getting dressed. There was a fad at the time, especially popular among my students, of trying to figure out how many of them could fit into a phone booth. For a while, this seemed to be among the most pressing concerns of the Eisenhower era. Will we obliterate the planet through thermonuclear war? Was a question right up there with how many co-eds can we stuff into this phone booth, this clothes closet, this refrigerator's cardboard box? Photographers and film crews would show up wherever a stunt was staged and record its hormonal hilarity for TV, film, and the pages of the yearbook. This persistent effort among my students to accommodate as many as of their young bodies as possible into a single cramped space was as much an attempt to exorcise the age's confusing combination of stifling conformity and unrestrained consumption as it was a rationale for sexual touching in a sort of unconscious dress rehearsal for the revolution to come. Look, I'm not tit grabbing for the sake of tit grabbing. I'm just trying to set a new world record for how many of my friends I can fit into a package of Cracker Jack. This cramming craze had also made it to cars, especially to old Fords like the one pulled up outside, which was of a model that many students of mine owned, handed down to them by their parents. And as I was shrugging on my coat, I had the idea that Netanyahu had broken down somewhere and had hitchhiked and some students picked him up. And then on the way to campus, the students had maybe gotten into an accident or something, which would explain the Ford's hood puffing Los Alamoses of popcorn cloud smoke and its busted fender sagging as it rattled past the Dulleses and stopped, blocking our driveway. I stepped outside just in time to catch the car's rear door opening and bodies pratfalling out. Not clowns in full bozo regalia, honking horns and juggling plates, but close enough. They were shirling clad kids, one, two, three of them. It took me a moment to count three of them, small, medium, large. Their identical sheepskin coats and especially their suddenly unconfined energy made them seem more numerous. They were chasing each other between the sidewalk and street and tossing snow as two larger adult forms slid out from the front door, curbside. The doors on the far side must have been jammed. These two adults at first seemed indistinguishable and completely androgynous as they were bundled up in bigger version sheepskins of what the little ones were wearing. Five identically furry toggle clasped coats, hopefully bought in bulk at a substantial discount, as the kids fire drilled around the car in a riot of snowballs thrown and dodged, one of the adults raised a hooded head to the sky and screamed out in that language that in my youth had been spoken by God. She, because the scream was a woman's, must have been telling the kids to stop running and shut up already. This was my first encounter with the Netanyahus, the whole family, die ganze Mishpacha. It goes on from there.
I love that section so much. I love the kind of brilliant irritability. Like it's almost as if, I sort of feel like irritation gets kind of like rubbed together in this kind of little smoke genie comes out. So I don't know, which I often feel in your writing. So anyways, it's great to get to hear you read that section.
Thank you.
I am going to read a section from this novel. Everyone knows Your Mother is a Witch, which is, Andy set it up pretty well. Basically, it's based on it's reality adjacent, like Josh's work. It sort of springs a sort of parallel river to a true history. And the true history is the astronomer Johannes Kepler, his mother, who was an illiterate peasant, and Kepler himself, who became sort of the imperial mathematician, was also basically a kind of a nobody from nowhere in a wonderful way. And naturally that left a mark on his family and on his town. So towards the end of her life, Katharina Kepler, who's raised her children alone, who's a widow, who's been making her own money for decades, which was not an easy thing to do, ends up being put on trial as a witch. And it's a little bit of an Oscar Wilde situation in the sense that she's kind of called a witch at a kind of drunken afternoon. And it's when she files for slander that the case builds energy and they kind of counterfile, and suddenly there's this big trial, which she's sort of brought into being simply by insisting on something true. So I was gonna read a little passage from some of the testimonies. The book is partially in her voice, partially in the voice of her legal guardian, and partially in the voice of the people in the town that she lives in, Leonberg, being called up to offer what they may or may not have to offer about her. So the first voice you'll hear will be the kind of interrogator. Thank you for coming here today. Do you understand that any false testimony you knowingly give will provoke God's great anger in your earthly life and will deliver your soul unto Satan upon your death? I've never heard of such a thing. But do you agree to the proceedings as described? I don't feel I have much choice, but okay, I'm here. State how old you are and what is your profession. I'm Daniel Schmidt. I'm 46 years old. I'm a tailor. There are 7 tailors in Leonberg, but my family has been tailors here longer than any of the others. Probably this is why Frau Kepler and her family chose to work with me over the years. Did Frau Kepler ever behave in a suspicious manner with you? What do you mean by suspicious? I have no complaints about anyone. I'm here because I was asked to come here, but I have no complaints against anyone. Can you tell us what happened when your child was ill? It wasn't one child, it was 2 children. Yes, can you tell us about that? The girl suffered even more than the boy. The names of your children? Lucia was 2.5, Hans David was not yet 2. And how did you come into relations with Frau Kepler during this time when your children were ill? I was doing some work for her in her home. She had a coat that was in need of mending and required a new lining. She also needed her dress to be adjusted. She had grown very thin. It was an extensive job, which I carried out well and for a fair price. When was this? 6 or so years ago. Frau Kepler, she said something intrusive to you, is that right? Maybe. What did she say? You probably mean that she said that my wife and I were suffering. She said that though we said our blessings in the mornings and in the evenings, still, difficulty met us at every turn. She was speaking of our children's illness. I didn't want to speak about it with her or anyone. She asked after Lucia and Hans David at every opportunity. She would visit us unannounced. Often she brought food. She also encouraged others to visit us. We never knew when she was coming or when the others were coming. It was a terrible time. One appreciates that others try to help, but also one wants to be left alone. I remember one difficult day in particular. My wife had taken the girl to the doctor in Stuttgart. It had been a long journey. The man was supposed to be an expert. My wife had put so many hopes in him. She insisted on the pointless trek. She is so easily convinced. I waited for her return with dread, without the smallest bit of hope. Little Hans David was crying the whole day. He wouldn't eat. He wanted his mother and sister around. Before my wife had even made it back to the house, when she was at the gate carrying Lucia, Katerina intercepted her. "What a cross you bear with this child," Katerina told her. "There's nothing to be done," my wife replied. "Your wife found Katerina suspicious." "My wife was suffering. That's her business. Only God knows." "What else happened at the gate?" "Katerina pressed my wife to try another treatment for the child. She told her special words to say. It was a song of sorts. My wife had heard the words before. It was a devilish incantation, something superstitious." "I can't say. Katerina told my wife that she had said the same words when her own child was sick. That child of Katerina's had died. Why even recommend the words? But Katerina said the words could do no harm. Maybe God would see to save the child. Katerina told my wife to say the words three times over at night under the full moon in the churchyard." "What happened to Lucia and Hans David?" "Both are in heaven." "Do you think the pagan words Katerina encouraged your wife to say harmed them?" "I think they're in heaven." "Did Katerina give the children harmful salves or trinkets in the guise of gifts or medicines?" "Sir, I have nothing more to say. Only God knows." "You said Katerina sent others to your home to visit when your children were ill." "We did have many visitors, too many visitors." "Did any of those visitors give you potions, salves, gifts, or lean over the crib with curse?" "I don't know why my children died. That is for God to know." "Could any of those visits, gifts, salves, potions, or words have led to the death of one or both of your children?" "Sir, do you have children? They are in the care of God at all times." "You cannot say that Katerina is definitively innocent of the deaths of your children." "Sir, I'm being forced to say the same thing again and again. I feel like a hooked fish waiting to be tossed back into the water. I don't have the answers you want. Look, if someone looked into the situation in detail, maybe they would find something of the nature you're seeking. But me, I can't say." So that's one little passage. I'll open it up to see Josh's face again. Yay!
Thanks for those readings. Let me throw out a general first question here that scratches at some of the backstory. Rivka, in the acknowledgments, you mentioned how Ulinka Rublak's book opened the writing of the novel for you. And I wonder if you can elaborate on that story a bit, and also Simon's sort of the birth and growth and function of Simon. Similarly, Josh, could you talk about how your conversations with Harold Bloom led to the Netanyahus and how the character of Judy changed the Blum characters?
Yeah, so, you know, everyone had their kind of their stress reading in the past 4 years or lifetime or decades or whatever it might be. But for me, I found that I became really obsessed with reading about the lives of scientists. I like in retrospect realized that that was like a way to read about politics. It didn't feel like reading about politics, since scientists are like close to or like associated with knowledge or pursuing knowledge or truth, and therefore get bullied, executed, or raised to tremendous powerful positions. You know, whether it's across history, that it just sort of, it kind of makes them natural soccer balls of a sort in politics. So I actually, you know, was trying to read more about Johannes Kepler, about whom there's almost nothing in the English language, even though he's sort of one of the most transformative mathematicians of the past millennium. And the only thing I could find in English that was substantial was actually a book about his mother by the scholar Ulinka Rublak that came out from Oxford University Press. And it wasn't really about Kepler. It was about Kepler's mother. It's called The Astronomer and the Witch. And it was just an absolutely, it's an academic book, but it's written for in a way that sort of anyone can enjoy. It's an amazingly well-written book. And one thing I found when I was reading it was that I was reading about a woman accused of being a witch, and I was reading it with suspense to find out if she was a witch. Like I felt inside of me this sense of like, oh, I wonder if she really was a witch or not. And that emotion was like kind of interesting to me. And there was also a detail in the book, just a tiny detail where sort of partially through the trial, which went on for 6 years, it was a mortal trial. You know, her legal guardian, she was a woman, so she couldn't represent herself at court. Her legal guardian, who was her neighbor, asks to be excused and basically says, I'm too old and frail and I can't do this anymore. And that detail kind of exploded for me because I thought, well, who is this person who has risked their reputation and livelihood by associating with an accused witch? And why did they step down and what was going on there? It was just like one of those kind of, you know, paper flowers that opens up in water. And so that ended up being kind of my way into the story. There's a character, Simon, who is her neighbor, who does what we all do, sort of like I often think most of us haven't been accused of being a witch, but most of us have watched someone undergo like a terrible and unjust persecution. I think that's something many of us have experienced. And just the ethics of that, I guess, kind of got me into the book, which makes the book sound quite serious. I mean, I always am writing, you know, generally with a sense of lightness, but that was my kind of way into the story.
I don't know. I feel bad, Rivka, about my pandemic or coping reading, whatever you're calling it. You know, I've not been. I should be reading about scientists. I don't know. I knew Harold Bloom insofar as anyone 50 years, you know, or more younger than someone can really know someone and befriend someone, and he was very generous about some books I'd written, and he wanted someone to talk to, I think, and someone who would bring him appetizing plates from Russ and Daughters to New Haven. And so I was that guy, you know? And I really wanted to hear about him, and not just because I was interested in him, but because it was a way of deflecting his criticisms of me, or just, you know, I mean, it was that classic older Jewish man relationship where it's, you know, the guy begins by saying, you know, I love your books, they're great, which means now let me tell you what's wrong with them. And I couldn't, you know, I could abide maybe an hour of that, 2 hours of that after, you know, a few, I just, in order to avoid, you know, throwing myself onto the tracks at Union Station in New Haven, I was like, well, you know, talk to me about your own relationship with writing fiction, because he wrote a very strange science fiction novel, and that was also my way of reminding him that he did. And also kind of speak about, you know, memoirs, because he never was a person to, you know, take on that project of not just creative writing in a you know, kind of substantive way, but also to write about himself. And which is interesting for a person who is, I think, most well known for various theories of influence, right? And in a way, it's easier to kind of see yourself and placed in a certain critical continuum if you are only a critic, right? If you're you know, dumb enough to write creatively, you know, you open yourself up, you make yourself vulnerable to a lot of you make yourself vulnerable to all of the possible accusations of someone whose taste is better than their talent, right? And so I wanted to get at his memories, and I think maybe I wanted to kind of throw some elbows and kind of get back at him for him telling me how many mistakes I made in whatever he was talking about. And so he would go on and tell stories about, you know, Paul DeMond and Derrida and apartment people from that he taught with at various schools. And then Bibi Netanyahu was on CNN, kind of, I mean, but it was that classic Trump was on for a second, and, you know, and then the volume was kind of lowered, and then Bibi shows up, and Bloom says, Harold says, you know, I met him, and I'm thinking, when he was UN ambassador in the 90s, did you meet at some Upper West Side thing that I wasn't invited to because I never got invited to these things. And also I was 15 years old. And, but no, I met him when he was 10 years old and his father came up and, you know, created a mess. And I had him tell the story and tell it again. And of course, because of his age and because he, you know, certainly had a unfulfilled creative impulses, the story changed every time he would tell it. And I found myself kind of, I was unable to get the story out of my head, or the many versions of the story out of my head, because it seemed at once just too perfect of an allegory, too stupid of a sitcom, you know, it seemed to kind of do everything at once and really present me with the two things I think I said I would never do. Right, which was write a historical novel and write a campus novel. And then I said, well, if I can write a historical campus novel, then I'll be all right. But yeah, and then Harold passed away before this thing was, you know, finished, and luckily Jean, his wife, is still around and was able to read it.
You had mentioned in the acknowledgments, you talk about Judith or Judy, mm-hmm. how sending the manuscript to her, talking to her about it initially, sort of ended up rewriting the Blooms, caused you to rewrite the Blum characters in some way. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, should I get my lawyers on the Zoom call?
Yeah.
All right, yeah. I mean,
they're standing by.
They're standing by. I hope not, because they're expensive, man. Are the taxpayers of Philadelphia covering my legal bills? I believe that there is. I mean, I believe this as a journalist, and I certainly believe this as a fiction writer, that when you're writing about people who could be identified or could be associated with real people, that, you know, that's a real responsibility, and that, you know, and not just out of fear of getting called out for getting something wrong. I mean, it's something I feel as a deep ethical responsibility. I feel it morally incumbent upon me to not betray someone's confidence in the service of telling their story. Right. I think I would maybe be easier to do it if I was transforming something more completely, and I could make the argument maybe to myself in a very squirrely and self-justifying way that the art, right, trumps. There's that verb. Anyone's claims to privacy. But what I thought was interesting about Judy's critique, and it's a critique I put at the end of the book, is she says, "Why are you so interested in Jews and all of this old shit? All of this stuff is over. The only thing that matters anymore is that technology is destroying us, taking away our privacy, and the planet is burning. And there you are yelling about Jews." And I think that's an important statement. And the way that it's delivered in all in caps with a lot of exclamation points, it's an important statement. I think it's especially an important statement to me because I think that books, you know, they don't exist in a vacuum. I'm well aware of the almost antiquarian nature of writing books these days. It's something like blacksmithery or fletchery or something. And for me not to admit that this is a occupation or this is a pastime or this is an art that goes against the grain is, I think, to be unfaithful to the time in which I live. And so I like letting in the world around me. And letting in the politics that are able to emplace literature within the context in which it was produced, because, you know, the opposition to the book, the opposition to me, the opposition to what I believe literature is all around us, and it affects the book anyway. I think acknowledging the climate in which the art comes to fruition is a way of, for me at least, of clearing the air. You know, it's saying, yes, guys, this isn't a television series, whatever television is anymore. You know, this is a book that requires us to be a little grown up here, but we can also be a little extreme, right? All the things that come along with the privacy of reading a book.
Do you feel something similar, Rivka? I mean, being true to the time, even though you're going with the 1600s here. I mean, clearly there's relevance with exactly what you're writing about to larger themes that we're enduring today.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of like the way Josh put it. So I'll just sort of like put it as like a chapter maybe at the end of my book, and then I won't have to do the work of thinking it through. I think that would be better. And I mean, the thing is, I sort of feel like there's always that wonderful triangle, and I've just never drawn the triangle this large between kind of what you're running away from when you write the book and its presence on the page as the, you know, what you're running away from is sort of in control of what you run to in a great sense. So I sort of feel like I sort of ran away from 2018 into 1618, but of course, like that completely frames the whole thing. Whether I want it to or not, it's not anything I would ever do deliberately, but it might be the reason, you know, people, unfortunately, like the number of stories of people being unjustly persecuted or like just going through something horrible, there's like millions and billions. And why does one seem like so vivid all of a sudden? And I think that's like part of the triangle with reality. And kind of, I sort of feel like I was interested also in the way that I actually would be curious to hear more from Josh about kind of how Harold Bloom became kind of a taxation expert. Like, I think in a sense, like that makes so much, like it's not just to add those extra layers of distance. And even in small ways, like I felt like, okay, like I'm writing a character who was illiterate, who literally couldn't speak for herself, couldn't represent herself in court. But I somehow feel, have this like strong conviction that I know what the voice should sound like. But oddly enough, with the character of the legal guardian who takes care of her, I didn't want to use the historical name because I felt I would be slandering him, even though like he's been gone for 400 years. In a funny way, I felt like I'm not slandering Katerina. And that's that intuitive weird space where I sort of felt like I'm not going to slander the legal guardian and ascribe this like whole inner life that might not be fair. And he probably stepped down because he was very old and tired and the trial went on for 6 years. So I do think I made some of those moves that Josh made because I was basically getting all caps emails from ghosts from 400 years ago, being like, you know, why are you even talking about this? Like, I was worried about my daughter, you know, whatever it is, like whatever the redirection might be. But sort of like Josh, I never thought I would write a historical novel, mostly because it's just like, that's not my gift. And then I realized how being an amateur was like really essential to me. Not that I'm at risk of being an expert in any field, but it seemed like really enticing to be even more amateur, because of course I'm an amateur about the 21st century, but I'm even more of an amateur about the 17th century. And that's an artistic point of view, to be a kind of a child or an amateur and not know much. So I found it kind of, in a funny way, easier to write than a contemporary novel, at least at that moment.
This from an audience member, Jessica. Thanks, this is wonderful for both of the panelists. I hope this doesn't sound hostile.
I'm really excited now.
I'm just seeking more precise distinctions. What fiction is not really adjacent? What fiction is not reality adjacent? Is it the use of archives that make this proto-genre distinctive?
Yeah, I don't know. Am I answering this, Rivka?
Well, then I feel like I was the one who thrust that word reality adjacent, so you shouldn't have to defend it. But I think the questioner has a good point. I sort of feel like every fiction, and in fact, every memoir, because like memoirs almost the most feel like works of fantasy to me. Mm-hmm. So I feel like they're always like coursing next reality. I guess for me, it was just that these projects are both have like these names that feel so have like this kind of facticity, this magnetic facticity. Like the name Netanyahu is just a kind of pole star of a name. I mean, whatever it is, you just like enter into the book with like this big crowd of reality. And I feel, unfortunately, I actually feel like Kepler, people have a smaller crowd of reality to bring to the table. But it's still, you know, it's still Kepler, the 30 Years' War, witchcraft. It's still a crowd of reality. And so I guess it's just that I think it's like further adjacent than other fictional projects. Like if I was writing, you know, when I'm reading a story, when I'm reading Raymond Carver, you know, to just choose like the kind of ur text that people cite as kind of realism, you do sort of feel like it's closer to the webcam, even though it's infinitely better than the webcam. But I sort of feel like these projects are have like a bigger distance to go because they bring such a crowd of reality to the table. They're not just sort of people. They're like, have this weird cameo effect. When Hitchcock walks into a movie made by Hitchcock, he can't just be a character. He's always also Hitchcock. So I feel like these have like similar cameo energy and obstacles, maybe. I don't know. What do you think, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, my first impulse to answering that question is like the worst impulse that I always feel that I have to apologize for, because most of the time when someone indulges the impulse I am about to indulge, it is like it's a completely cheap and bullshit move. But like, but in this case, I mean,
this is good suspense. This is like a good lead up. Suspense. I'm really excited to see where it's going.
And I hope this doesn't come off as hostile. But no, it's when it says reality adjacent, the question is whose reality, right? And that's the move I'm talking about. And the truth is that when you're writing a book about, you know, Netanyahu's, I mean, first of all, I wanted to say to you, we'll see what kind of name recognition Netanyahu's will have in 400 years. I still think Kepler's going to be fine. You know, I think if there's any recognition, it'll be robots reading, actually. So it'll probably be the same amount of recognition anyway. It'll just, you know, retrieve it from the memory banks. But I think that you know, had certain types of history if certain histories taken certain other moves, right? Galileo wouldn't be known, you know. Kepler might have been, you know, shunted to the side, right? Like and certainly with the history we have now, with the histories we have now, the reality of Netanyahu is understood very differently by a lot of people all over the world. You know, and even the narrative of how the family came to the United States is, you know, there are conflicting narratives and conflicting realities out there. So I think what I would say to that is that reality is always reality adjacent, you know, and or to paraphrase, you know, another scientist, actually mathematician, right? It's reality all the way down. And I think that's important to keep in mind, because for me as a fiction writer, and I suspect, you know, for you as well, Rivka, with and not just, by the way, with I think this book, I think with your story collection as well, is, you know, it's about choosing which of those adjacencies you're going to kind of go into and which you're going to take a little bit from and put together and combine. And I think it's the novelist who has that freedom to kind of go reality shopping, and it's kind of one of the few freedoms that novelists still have. So maybe we shouldn't mention it, or they're going to take it away from us. You know.
So this question is directed at Josh. For Josh, your books are shifting from the cerebral to the visual. The internet also plays a less central role. The Netanyahu's is the most visual and the only one of your books from the last 10 years to take place completely pre-internet. Could you talk about this evolution and this relationship between your narrative style and the internet?
I don't know. I forget. When did the internet start? I mean, that's the problem. It's just, I don't... I think that, more importantly, and maybe it's that this is a book that didn't take the internet as its subject. And so I tend to, you know, find within the subject matter or whatever I'm writing about suggests ways of writing the story to me. You know, I think that's why this book has letters of recommendation in it, you know, for Benzio Netanyahu to be hired, you know, one from rabbi at Dropsy College, used to be in Philly, and another from a colleague from the nascent Hebrew University. And, you know, those could have just have easily been long emails or chats, I guess. I like the idea of bringing other voices in. I think, you know, Rivka, I know you do too. I mean, that's an amazing feat in this new book, of just the kind of the chorus of voices that come along. I think that one of the things that is not maybe often talked about by writers when they do events where we're supposed to seem like we're thinking about important things like politics or whatever, is really that a lot of times a lot of our work is about figuring out how to get more than one voice into something, which is hard to do. And I think there's so much tendency, I think, in a lot of fiction these days to retreat to the first person, the I, where you can only speak for yourself. You can only see what's in front of you. You can't possibly take on someone else's experience. There being political obstacles to that. There being roadblocks of the imagination. There being roadblocks of fact and lack of access to, fear of being called out for being wrong. I think that I grew up as someone who really liked this idea of the omniscience of a novel, a third person. And I also liked the idea of the multivocal novel, where more voices got poured in and you got to hear from more people, from more perspectives. And technology is only one kind of subject matter, right? Or maybe a way in which that can be justified and its use can be justified. Another brilliant way that, you know, those voices can be justified are in testimony or interrogation, like in Rivka's book, right? I mean, but I think that so much of the problem since there's been this odd mistrust for a third person omniscience and for the author who kind of can float and inhabit all of these different voices is how does one find a formal way to inhabit and incarnate the varied world that we see out there and that we're exposed to through technology, right? I mean, how do we bring that multifariousness into our work? And that's what interests me more. Yeah. What about you, Rivka? You like a lot of voices. No, help me out here. I can't just
No. And I sort of just like the idea of sort of reversing the notion that the person we have the most access to would be a person who was just like us and who's going to monologue. They're just like the author outlook. Just in the sense that I feel like most people, at least just from personal experience, I feel like most people have no idea how they sound or how they're leaking their desires or fears. And in a sense, I feel like the person people tend to have the least insight into is the I. So the I voice to me has always made sense as the sound of someone lying to themselves, because that's what I feel like the I voice is usually doing. Whereas I feel like one thing that I feel most of us have a lot of access to is not necessarily what people's actual inner life or experiences, although I kind of do feel like there we do have some access to that, but we do know what other people sound like. Like, I feel like most of us spend a lot more time listening to others than catching sight of ourselves. It's almost even that thing where, like, you know, those like trick mirrors where you see how you look to other people, because we're used to like a flipped image. So we get to know ourselves in reverse, but they have those, I don't know, like in a like trendy bar or something, there'll be a mirror that like flips your image. So you actually see what you look like to someone else's eye, and it's completely disturbing. And it's the valley of the uncanny. And you're like, who is this stranger? So in a sense, I kind of feel like, to me, that makes sense artistically, that voice-wise, the only eye voice that feels legitimate is not like because that's a legitimate perspective, but because that's sort of fun to watch someone be wrong. Like, you're always wrong when you're sort of like narrating yourself. And you're wrong in a different way when you're listening, because you do actually kind of, you do have something more accurate about the way you can listen than the way you can self-report, right, which I feel comes into play in an artistic project. That's why I feel like, you know, it was interesting that Josh was pointing out how the one thing he was trying to draw Harold Bloom out in memoir, which was like the uncomfortable form and the form in which he got him to basically be a fiction writer. And so I don't know, I think there's something quite moving about that, about how you elicited a kind of true image of him by the way that he altered his story, even though that's not exactly the project in the book, of course, but it's sort of it's behind the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I like what you're saying about, you know, of course, the I is the unreliable narrator, right? And I think that coming up through books, right, and through reading books, part of that education is understanding that the ideas and perspectives and thoughts that characters are having aren't necessarily those to be attributed to the author, right? And that, you know, whether you believe in this Nabokovian idea that all these characters are puppets that are voicing things that an author wants out there, or whether, you know, these are based on real people and or composites that are these people that are put out there to kind of meet and meld and clash and in the way that we do in life. I think that to go from that education that comes through literature of sort of understanding the vessellization of an author through characters, and also the dispersal or the vessellation of the world through characters, and then to talk about technology, which was kind of part of the question, where after the age of fake screen names, we are our names are really made, you know, synonymous with our offline identities, and our online identities are now synonymous, right? They've been made identical. And in fact, it's only old people like me, you know, that like speak of a difference between online and offline life. And when you begin having your name and your identity identified with directly with all of the statements that you produce, you begin having, there's an enormous amount of pressure to not, you know, ruin your life. Not to mention offend anyone. And the freedom that comes with sort of the technology of the novel is, which is paleotechnic when compared to Twitter or Facebook or any social media, is just so much freer. And I think I wanted to also add to that kind of question about, you know, reliability. I completely, or about the first person always lying, it's true, but in a way, it's also that it's slightly easier to be honest in books now, because you can hide there because no one will read you. Or at least it'll take you a lot longer to ruin your life, because they actually have to read the book, or at least up until the offending page. And so I don't know. There is something, though, about an author being able to disperse themselves in the same way that an author disperses the world through characters, that seems to me to be a very precious thing that technology sort of augurs against, and that I kind of feel like in my writing I like protecting.
And, you know, I used to think of Twitter as, there was this kid's book when I was little, I wish I could find it again, about a family called the Stupids. They were just very stupid and they did stupid things, and that was the center of the joke. But one of my favorite kind of episodes of the Stupids is one winter, it was so cold that they had said all sorts of mean things to each other, but they had frozen, the words had frozen, but then it thaws. There's a long thaw in the spring, and all these horrible things that they had said in the winter are like melting, and they all get into big fights. I used to think, oh, Twitter is sort of like the Stupids, where the sort of transient, horrible you that like surfaced for like a minute kind of like becomes more permanent. But now I sort of think there's this way in which the meanest people just erase everything they ever said, but accuse everyone else of saying horrible things. Like, I've noticed that's like a new thing. Sure. Whereas the book sticks around. I don't know if you're,
I mean, what I thought was really kind of, you know, fascinating in many things fascinating about your book is is the medievalism, right? Or, I mean, this is slightly after, like, it's the late hangover.
It's almost a Renaissance.
Right. But I mean, it's the so-called age of rationalism, and yet not very rational.
Yeah.
And what I find kind of interesting, you know, Benzio Netanyahu is a medieval scholar, and but I mean, his specialty is 15th century Iberia, which there's a pitilessness to the time that Benzio Netanyahu studies, and there's a pitilessness. Certainly, in the lives of your characters, and in the fates that they face and could face for the crime of basically being, right, and I think that there is something, or there was something, at least for me, I'll speak for myself, right, of
for the eye,
of associating, yes. I'll speak for the very reliable eye, which has a real sense that I know what the medieval era, all the hundreds of years, was like from the Reconquista up until the edge of the Renaissance. And I can tell you that I really believe that that for people who study the period and people who become interested in the period, whether as academics or whether as fiction writers, there is this, this rubbernecking a car accident, right? You couldn't look away from the stupid, from the blood, from the pitilessness, from the absolute sense of unappealable fate or destiny visited down upon the heads of people by just sheer power. That cannot be countered, right? And there was such temptation for me to begin to draw those connections to certain things in our own era that we can complain about in the way that, you know, a lion would complain about having a little splinter, right? It shouldn't affect us this much, and so part of me really enjoyed making that connection, and a part of me also felt cheap about it. So I'm asking you, how do you feel, Rivka? Make me feel better.
I don't know how to make you feel better. But no, I do, I remember when I, you know, one thing that really moved me and surprised me, you know, for me, the thing that I always connect to about most of history is that losing children was just absolutely standard and everyone did it all the time and it happened again and again. And there was a part of me that just thought, oh, I guess it was the norm and therefore it wasn't so painful. It was just part of life. And that there's a passage where Martin Luther, he's lost, there's a letter from Martin Luther and he's lost his 8-month-old baby, his first baby is 8 months old. And, you know, Martin Luther faced a lot of persecution, had a lot of difficulty in his life. And he's completely destroyed by it. And himself is saying, I just don't know how I have this much emotion, basically about this creature who he himself knows he can't really know so well. And there was something, I'm not gonna make you feel better, but there was something about that which made me feel like the idea that these pains are so alien is insufficient, and that there are these sort of points of, and that the sort of the way that it feels just unbearably, that sense of helplessness and misery, that there is like a kind of way that you can actually connect to it, that it is sort of very human scale, even if like the juggernaut that bears down upon them is so much again and again worse than the juggernauts bearing down even on people not as fortunate as me and Josh. I did sort of feel like there was something just human about misery, that just, there's a sort of scale where you hit a certain scale and it's just, that's the scale. It's not like there's a bigger scale. It's just the everything scale. Not very helpful, but.
Well, you're never going to make me feel bad for Martin Luther.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just.
Let me jump in with a couple of audience questions here before we wrap it up. Josh, somebody asked, what motivated you to take on the project of Edward Snowden's memoir? I enjoyed the result, but why expend your energies on someone else's memoir at this point in your career?
I don't know. You ever had a job? I mean, does this person want to hire me? Yeah. I mean, because believe it or not, writing novels about the family of the outgoing Israeli prime minister doesn't bring home the bacon.
But wasn't that massively interesting? I mean, I it's not like you were sort of writing the biography of, I don't know. I can't think of the person who.
Yeah, I don't want to be uncharitable.
Yeah.
I just think it's the question at this point in my career. It's like at what point in my career, you know, at the point. Right. I think that it's a person whose politics I was sympathetic toward from before I met him, and a person who became and remains a very good friend. So, you know, it's always good making money with a friend. I learned an enormous amount. You know, I also wrote a book about, a ghostwriter works on a memoir for a tech mogul before I became an editor for Ed's writing. So that felt a little, I don't know, it's uncomfortable being a prophet.
Prophecy.
But no, I mean, I think that in every job I've ever had, I've learned an enormous amount. I mean, I really consider myself, I learned how to write by being a weekly journalist, you know, by writing weekly and by having to write a number of articles a week in language purged purged as much as I could of any voice. And it just, you know, it taught me how to arrange information and how to arrange facts. And it also really taught me that being clear about language will in turn clarify your mind and clarify your thoughts. I mean, I think that's the most important lesson that I learned from any apprenticeship in journalism, which is that you know, if you demand certain clarity from your sentences and you impose that clarity through certain following certain real rules and devices, it's not to make writing all sound the same, it's to bring a baseline clarity to your own thoughts. And that to me was probably the most important lesson I ever learned. That and also the lesson of fear, is if you don't write something, you're in trouble.
One last question, and this applies to both of you. Although somebody asked Josh, somebody says that the Netanyahu's kind of reminded them of Stoner. But somebody wants to know about books that affected both of your writing.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's so much. But I guess for this book, in a funny way, there's a book called Simplicia Simplicissimus, which is kind of a memoir type novel of the 30 Years' War, which was a war that went on for 30 years, in which sort of 30% of the population died, that overlapped with the time period I was looking at. And it was a really funny novel. It was just full of hijinks and sexual capers and just an over. And so there, you know, I guess that's the lesson you learn again and again, but that was like a book that was very important to me for this book, just for the way that people process trauma and pain, that there's many ways that people process it. Just as, you know, we learn again and again, I think sort of Catch-22 Joseph Heller is another great example of that, but that was an important book for me for this book, and it was sort of close enough to.
I wanted to ask Rivka. This might be totally insane. I was just gonna like look it up on my phone secretly while you were talking, because I wanted, because I remembered this, but I didn't have time to do that. You reviewed the. Which volumes of, maybe the whole thing of the Strach biography of Kafka?
I reviewed two of the three volumes. Yeah.
Two of the four. So I there was like an LRB thing, right?
Yeah.
All right, Fidelity.
I'm worried like one of my stupids is gonna melt. So I'm eager to hear what you're gonna say.
No. I mean, so good. I mean, so I wasn't.
Yeah.
Well, because I remembered that piece really, you know, because it was you know, the first reaction, I'm sure, is your reaction. When you get the assignment, you're like, oh God, writing about Kafka.
Right.
And then you're reading it, and it's just like, hey, right. And it's just like, and it was such a beautiful piece. I mean, it was really a great piece. And I remember thinking, like, this is the only kind of piece about Kafka that I wanted to read, kind of, at especially after having gone through the biographies myself, but and asking myself at some point why I did. But I was wondering, was there anything in kind of living in that world of those biographies and writing this novel?
Oh, you mean, was there a connection? I have no idea. But that, right. I really am glad you flattered me for the past 60 seconds. It felt great and I loved it. So maybe there was a connection.
Well, I mean, you know, because Kepler, you know, Kepler, Prague is a Kepler town.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's this kind of deep medieval, odd mix of like alchemy, magic, and science, right? And I just felt that, you know, and especially in the biography, which maybe doesn't belabor it, but definitely lays out a certain tradition, like Middle European tradition on the border between like science or, you know, and the witchy, let's say.
Right, right.
I was just wondering if, yeah, I don't know.
Well, you know, I hadn't really thought about it, but I had an experience with that biography that slightly paralleled the experience of reading the Olinka Rublak book. So I remember, I think if I have it right, I think it was sort of the summer of 2016 when I was reading that. And I was one of those people who was like, wow, this man is going to get elected. The way that biography starts is it actually starts with like a trauma from several hundred years earlier in Prague and then its repercussions. And it sort of seemed like it's not like there was any intervention to be made. This was just like this rolling kind of structural evil that was going to make its way forward. And I remember I couldn't sleep because the book felt so present tense, that biography felt so present tense to me. And I was reading it like I read it like a present tense book. So there was certainly that connection of this kind of diffuse, irrational, exuberant, destructive force. So this kind of like, it starts, you know, which is weak because it doesn't really connect to Kafka, but his milieu, that it had this thing that kept sort of rising up again. And that it was kind of an undeadness that was going to come back again and again. So not very strongly connected the way you're saying, but just that emotion.
Yeah.
Thank you. Josh, do you want to mention one book that affected your writing of this one and then we'll sign off?
Josh is the best reader I know, so he'd have to mention 101.
101. I don't, you know, I think that the book that I really, I'll tell you about the book I stole from for this book was a book, kind of a classic book, and maybe a lot of people know it. It's a book called Zahor. It's a Hebrew word, but it's spelled out in English. It's Z-A-K-H-O-R, I believe that's how it's spelled, by Yerushalmi, who is a professor, a Salo Baron professor of Jewish history at Columbia, actually, who died fairly young. But this is a book from, I think, I believe the 80s, and it's a very interesting book that, and it is sort of a specific, maybe too parochial for some people, book about Jewish history. But really at its heart is he asks, why do certain peoples have a historical impulse and others don't? And specifically, why is history or historiography, meaning the writing of history, absent from the Jewish tradition for a very long time and in favor, let's say, of a preference, in favor of stories or of myths or of sort of patternized cyclical tropes that that can be applied from one generation to another. In the same way that maybe Rivka was talking about this rising feeling of undead coming back and coming back, it was Yerushalmi's sort of contention that for a very long time, aspects of Jewish culture and Jewish history, the calendar recurring every year with the same holidays, you know, the week being structured by every seventh day, you know, a Sabbath, it really had this, every year kind of had this notion of an eternal return. So like in every, the idea that that history was never really affecting the Jewish people, that it was just actually the constant recurrence of the same holidays and the same seasons. And the, then the tendency to see every incidence of repression or slaughter to fit into certain biblical templates. And, you know, the, just like redemptions, like fall into certain templates, such as the Exodus from Egypt, and to see that recurring time and again in different cultures, and why Jewish culture preferred this patternization of stories versus history. And I just thought it was fascinating because, frankly, you know, this is a moment that we are return of our own cycles, where we are seeing. A moment in American history where we're talking about our own founding stories and where certain, you know, conceptions of, you know, what had been fixed history are, you know, being claimed or being shown to be, you know, children's stories compared to other forms of history, which have been, you know, which have been repressed or buried. And I, you know, these ideas of history versus story, I think are have always been interesting to me as a writer and as a reader. And so, yeah, that is the long answer to that question. Zahor, you can get a used copy for like a book.
Josh, thank you. Rivka, thank you. The books are Everyone Knows Your Mother is a Witch, The Netanyahu's. Folks, you can get signed copies through the Joseph Fox Bookshop, signed book plates. There's a link in the chat. Josh, Rivka, thanks again so much for joining us virtually. Maybe next year in Philadelphia, but probably not.
Jesus, okay. All right.
Take care. Bye. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you both. Thank you, everyone.
Nice to see you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.